Thank you very much, Dan. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, if there ever is a Nobel Prize for magnetic raconteurship, Professor Coase is my nominee. That was wonderful. Absolutely great. You know, when I was first asked to speak this evening by Tim Ferguson, who you all know with the Wall Street Journal, I said, great, that's an opportunity for me to talk about my favorite subject, education, or maybe the sad state of what I think is our education system in the United States today. And so I was really enthusiastic and was ready to get off and run. And then I received a letter from Dan Oliver, and he said, Joe, we'd really like you to talk about what makes businessmen tick. What do they say in the locker room? Why is it that businessmen, who should be the epitome of free enterprise, are the very people who, in many acts and statements they make, really support efforts that are fundamentally opposed to the basic principles of free markets and free enterprise. So, being kind of resourceful, I decided somehow I'm going to try to wiggle those two subjects together and get both of them across tonight. And I'm going to do that, Professor, in 20 minutes. So, here goes. Let me begin with my favorite subject, education. And maybe I can show you in the process of describing what we're attempting to accomplish in the state of California, how the business community in California has reacted so far, and hopefully maybe to give you some feel for my feeling that I think we can change some of the negative or passive attitude that's expressed by some of the business community with regard to this issue of providing parents with a choice in how their children get educated. To put the problem in context, and really what I'm going to say, although I'm going to use the state of California, what I'm going to say generally applies across the entire country. Our education systems are really failing our kids. You've seen all the comparisons of how we compare to our trading partners, really our international competitors, while a lot of their educational results are improving, ours are going downhill. We're on the last IEA analysis where they measured our 14-year-olds and our 10-year-olds. This is after a 10-year period. On that whole chart, the only country where the scores were headed south in both cases, both 10-year-olds and 14-year-olds, was the United States. Every single other country, Thailand and so forth, we're moving in an upward direction to the point where measuring our 14-year-olds in science and math, we were at the bottom, the very bottom of that list. Well, I don't have to tell you in this room that our whole way of life, it isn't a matter of can companies like mine hire qualified people and so forth. That's only a small part of the problem. The issue at hand is, can we maintain our whole way of life? Can we maintain our society as we know it? Can we maintain the standard of living as we know it with the coming generations of people who are completely ill-equipped to compete in the national markets? And the answer is a resounding no. If you look at California today, we have 5 million kids in the public school system. If we continue as we are today, 30% of those, or 1.5 million, will drop out before the 12th grade. Another approximate 2 million will graduate. Unfortunately, a lot of them will walk across that stage, receive their diploma, and not really be able to read what it says on the diploma. That is a sorry state. And so I, along with other businessmen and interested civic leaders, have for years tried to address this issue and address the question of how do we reform the system. And I've got to tell you, we've done all the things. We lobbied and got legislation for more funding into the schools. And people said, you got to reduce class size, and we reduced class size. And you got to have more training and staff development for teachers and administrators. And we did all of that. And we even did what I call the feel-good things. You know, companies go out and adopt a school for a year, or they'd be principal for a day and that sort of thing. The reality is, after 10 years of all these reforms, where are we? Things are worse than they were before we started. And what bothers me the most is that it took so long for us to realize and focus on what the real issue is. The issue is not more homework or more smaller class size or any of those. The issue is the basic system that we have is really, if you think about it, it's designed to give us the result we're getting, mediocrity. There is no real accountability in the system. There is no real competitiveness or striving for excellence. Sure, this is not to say that we don't have good teachers. We have some great teachers. We have some great administrators in the system. But the basic system is not one that encourages and incentivizes creativity, innovation, and so forth. It's one that drives toward a least common denominator, a bottom level of accomplishment. Let me describe what I mean maybe a little more clearly. If you look at the computer business today, IBM certainly is one of the most powerful companies with the greatest amount of resources and talented people and all the rest. But if you look over the last 50 years, you see here's this great company, and yet Apple Computer jumped up with a whole approach to the personal computer that really kind of caught IBM a little off guard, and they had to react to not only meet that challenge, but to try to be one better. And while they're doing that, up come two guys up in Palo Alto, Dave Packard and Bill Hewlett, and they come up with scientific computers that really kind of step up over IBM. And IBM has to run to catch up to that. And while they're doing that, there's DEC on the East Coast coming up with business computers that really are innovative and creative. Now, that's a perfect example of where a company as powerful as IBM, with all the resources that IBM had, if it weren't for those competitors, many of them started out on a shoestring, but if it weren't for those competitors, we probably would have had computers today, but I don't think anyone in this room would doubt the fact that we would not have the degree of diversity and innovation and creativity that we have just because that competition exists. And the thing that really bugs me most in talking to some of my colleagues in business is that, you know, they'll talk about free enterprise, they'll talk about the virtues of free enterprise. We even send teams to Russia to tell the Russians how they ought to make the conversion from socialism to free enterprise, and yet we here in this country run our education system, which is probably the most important responsibility we have to the next generation, on a failed concept, the very failed concept in Eastern Europe of a socialistic approach, a monolithic, rule-driven system. That's how we choose to run our schools. And so, without any question, after all of these attempts to reform and work with and through the system to reform it, it became eminently clear that what we had to do is introduce that innovative, creative competition if we were going to get the kind of result that we want. There are a lot of people who say, you know, what really ought to be changed in our educational system is we ought to have more homework, and we ought to do this, and we ought to do that. And basically, I think it doesn't matter whether Joe Alibrandi designs the system or Professor Coase designed the system or who designs it. What's wrong is that there is no design. What we need to do is have this living, creative, competitive innovation that's constantly adapting to the different needs of society. In other words, to provide a heartbeat in that system so that it is constantly striving for excellence rather than for a least common denominator kind of approach. And that's why I think we need parental choice in education. There is an example. A school in Corona, California. where the principal and the teachers got together and they said, you know, we don't need guys like Alibrandi telling us how a school ought to be run. We know how it ought to be run. And so they said, we're going to violate the rules, but we're going to go ahead and run this school on the basis of really getting down to fundamentals and providing kids with an education. So they called the parents in, and they set up contracts with the parents where they required a dress code for the kids and making the parents aware that homework was going to be required, and they expected the parents to oversee the homework. And they said, if we want parents to attend meetings once every 2 weeks minimum at the school, and if you can't do it, you don't have a car, you're too poor, we'll make arrangements to do that. And then they set up individual contracts with the teachers, including a dress code for the teachers. And the reason for these individual contracts was so that the ACLUers and others wouldn't come around saying they're violating people's rights and that sort of thing. They decided that busing was very, very impersonal, and they felt a responsibility to build a community as well as a school. And so they arranged carpoolings, complicated carpoolings, but nevertheless an opportunity for people to get to worry about each other and worry about each other's children and so forth. I can tell you this program has been in effect for about 5 years, and the results are startling. Startling to the point where my nephew lives just outside that community, and they have a process there where they take the kids within the community, and then they will take other children on a first-come, first-served basis. And the first-come, first-served for the year that my nephew's son wanted to go to the school was at 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning. On Tuesday afternoon, my nephew got a call from his wife, and she said, Andy, I just drove by the school, and I see fathers in the playground with sleeping bags lining up for the Thursday morning first-come, first-served. So she said, you better get home if we're going to get Michael in that school. So Andy went home, got his sleeping bag, and slept in the playground. They had a spiral circle of fathers lined up to the door, and he slept there Tuesday night and Wednesday night. This is the Lincoln Alternative School in Corona. Now, fortunately, little Michael got into the school. Now, I don't know how many of you are businessmen here, but I can tell you as a businessman, if I looked out my office window and saw my competitor across the street and I saw people sleeping in his parking lot to buy his product, don't you think I would get my people together and say, hey guys, at least get over there and find out what he's doing, because we've got to do him one better. How did the public schools react? How did the other public schools react? They wrote letters. The parents driving their cars, you know, their carpooling, came in at hours of the day where it clogged traffic and their buses couldn't get through. They were violating all sorts of different rules. You know, category one law such and such is being violated and all this sort of thing. And I think this clearly exemplifies the problem. Instead of reacting the way any business or any enterprise should react, and that is to find out what they're doing and come up with something better, they argue and fight the system to keep them from accomplishing what they do. And so this is why we need this parental choice. With parental choice, in spite of the fact that you'll hear the unions and others argue that this is going to destroy public education, and they'll make statements like this is evil and all that sort of thing, the reality is this will help public schools. This will improve public schools more than any other single thing we can do. I can imagine... I can imagine people in those other schools, parents in those other schools, showing up in front of that principal with a voucher for $2,500 or $2,600 and in essence saying to him, look, we have the power to take our child from here and put him in a private school, but we don't see any reason that we should do that. We'd like to understand why it is that if Mike, principal down the street, can do what he's doing, why can't you do it? And it's that kind of pressure and competitive response that we really need to get out of our educational system if we're going to achieve any level of success. It's amazing to me to see that in the state of California last year, the number one lobbying organization in the state of California is the California Teachers Association. $2,620,000 last year spent lobbying our legislature. I thought the teachers worked for the state. I don't understand why they would spend that level in order to lobby the legislators in the state. And that kind of brings me around to maybe addressing the question that Dan posed. Why do businessmen act as they do? I think fundamentally businessmen are basically free enterprisers. But I think that what is happening to us as a country, as government gets bigger and bigger, as you get more and more regulation, companies who are seeking a competitive advantage may see competitive advantage. A competitive advantage. And that is really sad because it says that as government gets bigger and bigger and you get more and more regulations, you're going to have more and more of that. One of the things I didn't read to you on this list is that even though the California Teachers Association was number one, I got the top 10 and I'll just read them quickly. Number two was the Association of California Insurance Companies. Three, the Western States Petroleum Association. Four, the California Medical Association. Five, Pacific Telesis Group. California Manufacturers Association. California Trial Lawyers Association. That's no surprise. California Cogeneration Council. Metropolitan Water District of California. And Waste Management Incorporated. Now, clearly, what we've done is create an environment where we all sit in this room and we like to think of free enterprise where I get out and compete with somebody else on the basis of producing a superior product at the lowest possible cost with the greatest reliability and greatest quality and all that sort of thing. But in fact, we're changing the rules. We're changing the rules to where my ability to influence legislation that maybe can hurt you or put me at an advantage to you is where I spend a lot of my time and energy. And sure, some of these lobbyists are spending money to keep bad regulation and bad law from being written. But you know, you kind of have a problem there because as you lobby legislators, they have a way of remembering that maybe you owe them something. So the next time around, you're going to be supporting something that maybe doesn't fit your basic ideology of the way you think things ought to be. I remember our former governor, George Duke Majan, addressed the California Business Roundtable at a meeting, and I thought he was great because he was frank and honest and open. And he said, you know, I want to hear about you guys complaining about some of the legislation that occurs and so forth, because I've looked up where your contributions go. And amazingly, not amazingly, but sadly, an awful lot of companies are making contributions to that end up in organizations that are geared to doing the very kinds of things that hurt those basic companies. And you see that day in and day out. And people rationalize, businessmen rationalize those. Well, you know, I gotta keep the bulk of the legislature happy and I've got to do this. We're kidding ourselves. We're kidding ourselves. As businessmen, we've got to decide what it is we believe in and support those issues that are conducive to free enterprise and fair competition. We will never get there by prostituting ourselves and trying to play both sides of the street. And I think that's a lesson for all of us as businessmen. And I think you might be surprised as many of you explore where the contributions that you or your organizations or your companies make, you may be surprised at where some of those really end up. Let me conclude my quick 20 minutes by really going back to the education issue, if I may. We're in a tremendous battle in California. And it really, truly is not a battle for just California, because I think
certainly the unions and the bureaucracy, the education bureaucracy all across the country, clearly realizes that if we get educational choice, parental choice in California, where the momentum has changed, the momentum has moved, and it's only a matter of time that people are going to have the freedom to make a choice across the country. As time goes on, you're going to hear their campaigns, and some of the ones that really get to me are, this initiative will destroy the public schools. And when you ask, how does it destroy the public schools? Well, kids are going to leave the public schools and go to private schools. And you're going to use taxpayer money to support the private schools. In fact, you have to ask the question. You know, it's kind of the Berlin Wall syndrome. If you knock down the Berlin Wall, everybody's going to run out. The question is not, if you knock down the Berlin Wall, why do people run out? You have to ask yourself, what is it? Why is it that they would leave? In other words, what they're almost saying is that unless they operate under the force of law to keep these kids in these inferior, bad schools, the kids are going to leave. Sounds to me like that's what freedom is all about. So I assure you, you're going to hear a lot of these issues, but really when you cut through all of that, what it comes down to is power and money. When you ask them what's wrong with our educational system, what's wrong is we don't give them enough money. Or society has changed. Parents don't really care. Parents don't participate, and that sort of thing. And when you really look at what that system has done to parent involvement over the last 20 years, you bus kids halfway across town, you wonder why parents don't go to the school every other day. You know, you get a 4-3 vote in the Los Angeles Unified School District to distribute condoms in the schools. And by the nature of the fact that it was a 4-3 vote, that says there are a lot of people who didn't believe that was the appropriate thing to do. But what happens to them? They have no choice. They have absolutely no choice. Only if they're rich enough to send their kids to private school or to buy a house in a different neighborhood do they have any kind of a choice. So there's a massive amount of people, poor people, who are trapped in a system that's going to keep those kids from being able to constructively join society. And so what's going to happen to those kids? They're going to be on welfare. They're going to be in the prisons. They're going to be the people who are selling drugs and mugging people who are trying to work for a living and that sort of thing. And it's not only bad for the rest of society, but it's really criminal for us to not give those kids an opportunity to constructively join society. And so that's what this is all about. We can have all the wars on poverty and wars on crime and wars on all these other things, but we're dealing with the symptoms. Unless we give these kids an opportunity to get on that first rung of the economic ladder, we'll never win the wars on poverty, crime, and all the rest. And we'll pay a tremendous price, a far greater price than we would pay if we put the money toward educating our kids. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Joe. We're delighted you came to talk to us. We're delighted to have you on our side, and we're delighted to be on your side. I have for you a present. This is our honorarium. The entire thing is contained in this box. It is an Adam Smith tie. It was worn by a number of people during the Reagan administration for almost 8 years. And but I have to tell you that the former Attorney General has determined that wearing the Adam Smith tie can be hazardous to your health.